thanks so much for coming along. I didn't check my emails again, so I didn't realise this was half an hour. So I'm going to have to talk very, very fast. I'm not going to finish the talk that I think I might do. I will continue it outside. Anyone who wants to join me, we'll just walk around, OK? I'm going to start off, before I get on to the actual monkey cage stuff, I want to start with something upbeat, because I will warn you, I am going to be talking about some stuff which kind of really, really broke my heart and which I've never really talked about on stage before. But this felt like the right place to, because this is such an inclusive space, such a beautiful space. You know, I feel sad that I've never come here before, because I just wandering around here, it just is very much the kind of thing that I love to see. So I'm going to start off, though, just with another festival poem. Last year, when I was in Glastonbury, I was wandering around, and my favourite thing in Glastonbury is not the main stage, it's just to eavesdrop in the corners and near the hedges. And on a Friday morning, I heard a woman who appeared to be trapped in a hedge say what I think is one of the greatest sentences I've ever heard, which was, "Do you think a cream tea will help null the effects of the acid?" So, and I thought, if that doesn't deserve a poem, I don't really know what does. So, this, for anyone from Cornwall and Devon, you'll enjoy the title of this poem. It's called Jam First or Acid First. "Do you think a cream tea will help null the effects of the acid?" he asked in an uncertain reality or a possible dream. You see, here, Woodstock meets the West Country. Lurpak meets Timothy Leary. Clotted Cream meets Ken Casey. Roky Erickson meets Robertson Jam. "Do you think a fruity scone will get the bad thoughts gone? Do you think a pot of Darjeeling will stop the screaming? Or is PG better with LSD? Stay away from the hot scrumpy, at least until you stop talking to that tree, that daisy you proposed to earlier. It's getting pangs of jealousy. Tell you what, split the difference. Manage your mind with a pink French fancy. Because you see, there's no bad trip with Mr. Kip Ling." So there we are, that's the first one. And I don't think you're not getting any audio out of the computer, are you? But let's not worry about that now. Just imagine, every time I do a poem, imagine your own tune. Let the freedom arise. So I'm going to talk about... Infinite Monkey Cage was a job that I loved doing. It was something that I came up with a title, I think, very much in terms of the content and the shape of it. And so it absolutely broke my heart when... It was actually September last year that I decided I had no choice but to resign. And I'm going to fill you in on some of the kind of details. Now, oh, the music started now. This is good. Well, we're going to do, I'll tell you what, we'll do music for the prose and we'll do silence for the poetry. Let's see how that works out. Everything's an experiment. It's all play. That's what I love. So anyway, The Infinite Monkey Cage, about 5 or 6 years ago, I started to notice that there were friends of mine who were getting an enormous amount of abuse if they said anything positive about the trans community or in any way showed they were trans allies. People like my friend Josie Long, Grace Petrie, Carrie Ad Lloyd, Tara Flynn, amazing human beings. And it made me, eventually I just thought, hang on a minute, if I don't say anything, then I'm not an ally to them. If I stay silent while these four women take on all of this abuse from, you know, the Linehans, etc., then, well, I've just got to open my mouth. So one night, 25th of August it was, in fact, I even remember that, I just thought, I'm going to just put up something, because I'd noticed that Graham Linehan was being, I hate using his name, actually, that bloke, anyway, so that he was being celebrated as a feminist icon. And I thought, how can he be a feminist icon when he attacks any woman who disagrees with him in however gentle a way? So I just put up a thing saying, I find it quite strange that someone is being called a feminist icon while attacking any woman who disagrees with them, right? So I just put that up on a line and then I went to sleep and I knew that I would get a huge amount of shit, right? I know that's the way it works, right? And then the next morning I woke up and I went, oh, right, here we go. And I went to look and there was nothing. And I thought, I should have spoken so much earlier. I've got nothing, nothing's been said. And I just went through the day thinking, wow, that amazes me. It's very different to the world I thought. And then I started getting text messages from people saying things like, really sorry to see what's happening to you, really sorry to see the kind of death threats and people calling you all these things. And that's when I remembered that I'd turned off my ability to see comments under that piece. And It turned out there were a lot. There were thousands, right? And so from that point onwards, though, this became a huge problem at the Infinite Monkey Cage, which was I would get told, could you not say anything positive about the trans community? Because it creates a lot of problems for us. People would write to the BBC. There was, you know, I think one of the mistakes sometimes I almost feel that people like Josie and Grace and me have made is that maybe we didn't manage to just keep talking about how many death threats we got and how many, because it managed to look like, you know, the Rowlings, etc. They've been very good at making themselves look like the victims while at the same time being the bullies. And so I get told things, people would say things like, they'd write to the BBC and say, I should not be allowed to present a science show because I did not understand the science of gender. So this kind of stuff went on and on and on. Then, in fact, I'm going to do a little poem about, because yesterday was Trans Pride in Brighton. And next week, of course, it's Trans Pride in London. And about 3 weeks ago, I was walking through Plymouth. I couldn't stay around, unfortunately, Saturday. It was Trans Pride in Plymouth, and I walked past a man, and he was walking his dogs, and he had a Proud Dad T-shirt on. So I thought, I'll just write a little poem about this Proud Dad. He's walking his dogs with his Proud Dad T-shirt on. Lines of love in blue and pink, a symbol of solidarity he might not have imagined in those early days of infancy. But he wants all to see that he will face that ignorant hate. Say out loud, the problem's not my child's existence, but this sunk cost persistence of your need to alienate. While you recline in that petty mind, every day I find another way to feel a love that bursts my heart while you go thirsty. And that night, I got various messages from people on Instagram, very nice messages, lovely things. And then there was one message from a man who put up a photo of himself. And I thought, that's the bloke that I walked past, that I said nice T-shirt to. And I got in contact with him. I said, was I the guy who said that? He said, yes, you were. And he told me he was marching for his son, Luca. And he told me that tragically, Luca's not with us anymore. And when I heard that, it reminded me again of why I did the right thing to leave an institution that is filled with transphobia. And I know they'll say that's not... And it's not just the transfer, right, also in terms of mental health. Like a while ago, I was diagnosed by an autistic stranger as being neurodivergent. How it had got missed by so many, well, it hadn't actually got missed at all. If anyone here has ever seen me live, you will know quite regularly, people will come up with lists afterwards and say, here are the 29 stories that you started but did not finish. Please finish 5 of them so we have a sense of closure. So... lots of people knew, and I would often get neurodivergent people coming up and they say, oh my God, didn't know you neurodivergent too? And I'd say, well, I don't think I am, I just think it's the way that I perform. But fortunately, a man called Jamie and Lyon, if you don't know Jamie and Lyon, go and look at Jamie and Lyon's work. Jamie is a great activist, a great human being. And Jamie just basically, he kind of saw my work and he'd seen it for a while and he got in contact with me. He said, I think we should have a word about your mind. Could we have a chat? And we did, right? Now, again, this was received very negatively by the BBC. I've got an official diagnosis. I didn't want one. To be diagnosed by an autistic stranger who works in that world, who is his life, was more than enough for me. But I knew that I would also need, if I was going to write a book about this, otherwise people go, he's not got the proper certificate, has he? But it was very, very negatively dealt with. And then I suddenly one day, again, I'd got into some other trouble. I'd put up something, again, very gentle in support of the trans community and about the societal nature of gender. And I suddenly get a meeting with my agent. My agent says, just so you know, some of the people who work in Monkey Cage believe that you have you're having a mental health episode. Yes, empathy is a mental health episode, if you'd not realised that's the way society works. And that absolutely floored me. And because it wasn't about anything that I did within the show, it was about who I appeared to be from social media and who I was on stage. And it absolutely broke my heart, and it became very difficult for a while, and it nearly led to the end of the show then. But it didn't become the end of the show. Basically, I just eventually said, oh, yeah, it was all my fault, because that was the quickest way to kind of get rid of it. But I wrote about it in my book, Normally Weird and Weirdly Normal. And what I wrote about was I actually got rid of a huge amount of anger and blame. Because I thought, right, I'm going to get rid of all that, even though some of the versions, if you saw the truly furious versions, and you will, but I just turned it into being an illustration of the fact, and I bet many of you have experienced this, that when you're better is when people often go, oh, you must be ill. Because they recognize, they like the person you were, the person who could be manipulated, the person who could be shut up, the person that could be bullied. And when you become more confident in yourself, they go, oh, they seem very happy. They must be ill. So when I wrote about it in the book in this very gentle way, the BBC, I then had a meeting with them, and they said, we believe you broke a bond of trust by writing about it. Now, not only did I remove a lot of the, well, all of the worst stuff that happened to me, but also I said to them, so you're saying that you can say to me, you've got a mental health problem, but shush, it'll be our secret. And I thought that is not a good, so at that point, I knew things were falling apart. And then the final one, and this, there was a various, this is another one. I just went over on the train here. I looked at some, because I made loads of notes about what happened at the time. Things that the BBC didn't like. When Donald Trump got into power for a second time, I put up on various occasions the fact that he is a convicted sexual abuser, right? He is convicted of that. Before we even find out the truth of Epstein, and Jesus Christ, the fact that none of those men have in any way faced any kind of, is disgusting, right? And I was told, oh, don't, could you not say that? It might damage our American following, right? I don't give a fuck, right? I don't care. Anyone who can support anyone who is a rapist or a sexual abuser, a predator, a psychological abuser, do you know what? I'm fine if they don't fucking come to my gigs and they don't buy my books. Because that's the thing, right? We need to stand up now. I got told off because, I retweeted a joke by the comedian Mitch Benn about Liz Truss. That was seen as an extremist gesture. Again, as you remember, the BBC has a left-wing bias. And, I mean, at one point they actually said they believed that I was damaging their journalistic integrity. But I said, I think you're doing a very good job of that on your own. And then there was one time as well, I very gently put up something about Stephen Fry, right? Because I saw Stephen Fry did a panel with someone that certainly within my world, I think is well known as a predator in the world of science, and with a far right journalist who is an active racist, right? And I thought, hang on a minute, to sit with, so all I said was, I'm disappointed to see you breaking bread, or not even to him, I just said, I'm disappointed to see that, and that might damage our relationship with Stephen Fry. So these are all the kind of issues that you end up dealing with. And then the final one was, I have a friend called Lucia Osborne Crowley. I don't know if any of you know her work. If you don't, please, after today, go and look up her work. Lucia wrote, she's written some amazing books. One of her books is called The Lasting Harm. She went to the Ghislaine Maxwell trial every single day. She got up at 1 o'clock in the morning and stood in the New York winter to make sure she was one of the four journalists that got actually inside the courtroom, right? She is a survivor of abuse herself, right? She wrote this book, and she is one of the reasons that I resigned, right? Because when I saw someone like her who has faced so much and does not have the advantages I have of being a white middle-class bloke and all of those other things, right? And she was, someone else I mentioned, Audre Lorde, the great poet Audre Lorde, who said, your silence will not protect you. The great poet Andrea Gibson, who tragically died last year, Andrea Gibson said, the truth may not be hopeful, but the telling of it is. All of those women were in my mind when I was thinking, I can't still go on with this, right? And this was the one that really did for me, was when Donald Trump went to Windsor Castle and, led by donkeys, projected that image of him with Jeffrey Epstein. I just put that up on my blue sky and I said, unfortunately, being a sexual predator has never been a hindrance to getting through the gates of a castle, right? And that is historically accurate, by the way. And then I mentioned some of the people who are very, very close to the person who is currently the king. Lord Mountbatten. You can look that up easily. This is not David Icke stuff. This is just out there and just not mentioned. Lawrence van der Post, who was his cultural guru. Peter Ball, who was one of his religious gurus, who in fact Prince Charles, when Peter Ball was eventually sentenced for some of his paedophile activities, Prince Charles, King Prince Charles, whatever, he wrote a letter saying that he hoped he was dealt with leniently. So to me, this is not far out shit. And that was the point when they said that this had created huge ructions that I went, I can't be part of this system. You know, and I look back now and I was probably part of that system for too long. And that's the bit, that was the bit that broke my heart. It's not just, I don't care about the show in one way. I loved making that show and we made over 200 episodes. It was time for a change anyway, to be quite honest. So it's not about that. It's about when you really see a system that you already have so many suspicions about and you realize who it protects and you realize that we're not so far, you know, oh, Jimmy Savile could never happen now. Really? Really? Couldn't it? I think people are very good at saying, Viktor Frankl, the psychiatrist, existential psychologist, he was in Auschwitz and when he left, he was one of the few Jewish people to go back to Vienna. And he said every day people would come up to him, they'd say, oh, Victor, I'm so sorry, we didn't know. I'm so sorry, we never knew. And he said, I really believe that they didn't know, but I believe they put a huge amount of effort into not knowing. And that's what we need to make. I'm going to do two poems now. Sorry, by the way, I've really rambled and gone at incredible pace just because I don't read emails. And it's probably the most useful thing that my book says for anyone who reads it is always put anything you need to tell me in the first line. Everything else is lost. I'm going to do a little poem about Lucia. I think we might have some music now, but like I said, Lucia is a remarkable human being. Lucia Osborne Crowley, The Lasting Harm. There are many others as well, but this is about Lucia. She stands alone above the grate, waiting for infrequent subway exhalations while the rest of her remains in refrigeration. Even New York's predominantly asleep. She's the minority, but she must be wide-eyed if she's to wake others from their slumber. She waits to escape the dark, enter a bulb-illuminated room, which will be blackened soon by children's stories, finally struggling to the light. Despite the persistence of money, demanding legal shrouds cast clouds upon the evidence, Lucia hears. Lucia listens. Lucia carries their story too. While years of dehumanizing demonizes the testimony, she can see beyond the trickery of power. She's seen their hands. She's felt their grip. They're women now, but children still. For the abusers, a cheap thrill of fingering a kid, of feeling their prowess by fucking a 15-year-old. These stories must be told, but so few will put them onto paper or into conversation, risk amplifying children crying for a savior and offering an embrace that's not a threat, but one that says, your words are heard, and you are believed. And this one, hopefully most people, this is just one called Not All Men. You probably know it's one of the common things. So come on, not all men, not all men. And it's just, it's a lousy thing. It's not good enough. It's not good enough for us to try and get out for every man here for us to go. And I know that probably, I hope within this kind of space that most men are not doing that. But that bit of us just to feel this is not, so, you know, everybody, it's like when people go, oh God, you're a bit woke, aren't you? Well, I'm bloody glad I am. I'm 57 and I'm woke and I've met the anti-woke. And you know, we are with the anti-woke talk about. All they talk about is the woke. It's so boring. Whereas if you're woke, you talk about all manner of stuff, from herons getting concussed at London Zoo to all manner of 19th century circuitry. So anyway. So this is Not All Men. Not all men, sure. But, well, so many. And as one, negligibly, some very male males may say, I cannot comprehend how so many abuses never end. The man whose legs spring open like misogynistic secateurs as he takes the train seat by your side, blurs the boundaries, both ambivalent to your existence, but the knee rub is persistent. A woman smiling at a stranger shouldn't lead to danger, yet friendliness so often deformed into an offer. All that late night threat dismissed as just a joke or you're too woke. In Washington, a house has opened gates again on a relentless predator, while previous presidents cajoled fellatio and then post-priapism, flaccid and furious, turned their flirtatious face into angry denial. That woman, that woman. A comment on a stranger's breast and all the rest should surely be confined into a past, but still, not yet. If we wish to be not all men, if we wish to prove Solanus wrong, then we will show that to be truly strong, a man won't stand in silence while his sisters fight alone. And we're going to get... And now it's hero time, so I'm going to talk about Greta Thunberg, because Greta Thunberg, in terms of, but just as a human being, as someone who is a great example for anyone who still goes, oh, autistic people don't have any empathy and all of that crap, right? Greta Thunberg is just so many wonderful things. And one of the things that I love about her, including the activism and her strength and her courage, is also her ability to always do over any boring man who tries to bully her, right? It's one of the most beautiful things. Come on, everyone, let's go and bully Greta Thunberg. It'll be really good fun. And then they all come back about 5 minutes later going, it was really unfair. She was really rude to me. And she made fun of my willy. So, this is for Andrew Tate. There are a few things I like more than seeing Greta get the better of yet another pompous predator. With this new fail, the alpha male slides down the Greek alphabet like a mole rat on a helter-skelter, bumping his head on Kappa and falling ever deeper into the crapper. Another autistic hero shows up another macho zero. And the next one I will go into is, this is a quick poem about when I was, my brilliant friend Josie Long, hopefully many of you follow her work. Josie is a brilliant human being. Josie Long and me were playing a festival called the Larm Weekend, and we were sharing a holiday cottage. And when I arrived, because she didn't have her kids with her, she was just so excited, and she went, oh my God, I've just found out we've got a jacuzzi. We have to have a jacuzzi tonight. And I went, oh, but I don't really have jacuzzis. They're not my thing, Josie. She went, I don't care. It's my holiday. We're having a jacuzzi, right? And said, we're going to drink cava in the jacuzzi as well. I said, it says no drinking in the jacuzzi. Said, are you a man or a mouse? So anyway, I was like, oh, God, I'm going to have a jacuzzi. Oh, God, I've never really had a jacuzzi. And then we go down the hill to go and watch a wonderful musician called Steve Wynn. And when we finish watching Steve Wynn, the comedian Stuart Lee comes along, and I think, oh, thank God for that. Stuart Lee will get me out of the jacuzzi, because any of you are fans of Stuart Lee, yeah, he's not got a jacuzzi happy face, has he? He's got a miserable old Solly Hull face, right? And so I thought he'll get me out of that, but I misjudged it, because Stuart just went, oh, wow, I've just heard you've got a jacuzzi. Oh, wow, that's brilliant. Yeah, because it's not only the warmth of the water and the way it moves around you, but also the bubbles quite often burst in a similar rhythm to some of Steve Reich's early 1970s free jazz experiments, right? So it was a nightmare on all sides, right? So, and anyway, so we did, we got the most expensive carver in Larne, $6.99 a bottle, 2 for $12. We're not idiots. So, this is a little poem, because basically what we talked about was weird music and Marxism. So, this is a poem called Trotsky Hot Tub. How can this be? Stu and Josie and me all in a jacuzzi. They'll say, you can't be lefty, too much luxury. Water bubbling like lava and you're swigging kava. I thought you lot wanted to ban fun. But as Alexei said, champagne socialism is champagne for everyone. I actually just saw my notes and I didn't do the first line, which was setting the whole thing up, so nothing changes. The brilliant Alan Moore, I'm sure many of you probably will read Alan Moore, Watchmen, V for Vendetta, Lost Girls, so many other things as well. Alan is a very, very wise person. And Alan, I think, realises that he's neurodivergent now at 73 because, apart from anything else, you don't write a book longer than the Old Testament about the boroughs in Northampton without having a bit of hyperfocus. So... And Alan one day said to me, and I thought this is such a perfect way, and this is very much, again, the problems of what happened with me, the BBC, and Monk Age. He said, what I've realised is, he says, the neurotypical world moves very much vertically. It's about climbing up and getting more power and looking down on more people. He said, I think the neurodivergent world is far more horizontal. And I thought, and for me personally, and for most of the people that I know, I think that's true. You're not very good at deference. Because why are you bowing to someone? You're very good at not judging anyone. Like, I mean, I think that's why things like, you know, in terms of, you know, non-binary, I don't really have, there's no issue on it because I think it's always been a weird thing to go, you are a man, you are, you know what I mean? It's like, so that whole thing of the horizontal means it doesn't matter about class, ethnicity, sex, gender, age. I mean, that's one of the things I think with age, you know, where sometimes we have this world where people go, oh, young people are like this, aren't they? Oh, old people are like this. And it's just not true. You know, some people are pricks when they're 18 and pricks when they're 97, right? That's just the way it is. And, you know, anyone who goes, kids, they're always looking at their screens. I will always remind them, when we were children, we used to watch the test card. So I don't really feel that we've... We used to hungrily wait for CFACs, you know. So I think that I love that bit of realising. And I think that one of the great examples of this was we had Judi Dench on the show, right? And before she arrived, this to me is very much the vertical way, right? The producers, they go, when Dame Judi arrives, make sure you're ready to receive Dame Judi. And then we'll take Dame Judi upstairs. And it was like, and she was almost like kind of curtsying every time. I said, look, the first thing is she won't want to be called Dame, I reckon. So we can all call her Dame once and she can tell us off and then we can call her Judi. I said, the second thing is I'm going to tell her lots of dirty jokes just to relax. Her. And the producer went, Ashton, and went, what do you mean? You can't tell Dame Judi Dench dirty jokes. I said, why not? She really loves rude jokes. She went, I wouldn't imagine so. What, because she's 89 and a Dame. She suddenly goes, I've never heard of sex. Right? I just... And she went, well, how do you know she likes rude jokes? I said, Barry Cryer told me. And that sorted that argument, right? And so... But this was the thing, right? So whereas I looked at her as being a fascinating human being that I had a huge amount of respect for, they saw her as Dame Judi, and then she was forced to do a promotion for our show. And I said, why are we making her do that? She can't read anymore. You know, she's pretty much blind. We're putting her in an awful situation. And they went, no. I said, look, why don't we just take something from the show? Nevertheless, they make her do this thing. When I go up just before the recording, so she's done the promo, I say to her assistant, oh, is Judi all right? She just sat outside on her own. She said she just feels that she didn't do a very good job for you. And I was so angry that she'd been put in that position, but I thought, that is how the vertical works. The vertical bows and then says, I wonder what I can take. You know, I never trust, you know, when you're in a room of people and you see how people change depending on who's the most powerful in the room, that's the vertical system. The horizontal system says, I've found someone interesting and it doesn't matter that it's not going to change my career because I'm going to have an amazing time. And I'm just going to, oh, by the way, one of the rude jokes I told her, I don't know whether to tell you the rudest one. Oh, it sounded like the baby wanted it, the rudest one. So, yeah. So, Billy walks into his mum and dad's bedroom and his mum and dad are having sex. And his dad sees, he goes, oh, Billy, for heaven's sake, get out. I'll explain everything later. Right? And Billy goes back to his bedroom, all confused by what's been going on. And then his dad, an hour later, thinks, oh, I better go and explain everything to Billy. So he gets to the door, and just as he gets to Billy's bedroom door, he hears this really weird noise. He's like, God, what on earth is that? And he opens the door, and there is Billy having sex with his grandmother. He says, Billy, what on earth are you doing? And Billy says, yeah, not so funny when it's your mum, is it? So she thoroughly enjoyed that one. Right. I've run out of time, so I won't do the Judi Dench poem, but I will. I'm going to end on this, a poem called Woke. I'm sorry if it was all over the shop. It nearly is always all over the shop, but I think it was all over the shop in another way this time. Anyway, it always fucking is. Shut up. Right, so Someone didn't take their sertraline this morning. Anyway, so I'm full of rage and I'm full of love. I'm exposed. The rage grows from the love. The love sweetens the rage, gives it reason, gives it purpose, gives it energy. A rage for creation, a rage for inclusion, a rage to catch others if they start falling. I want a world that evolves, that exposes hate for what it is, a carapace for power to manipulate, to take. I offer rage and I offer love. It will not be warped or distort me. It will power me. I rage for community. I rage for beauty. I rage for a unity of ambition that says, you are included. We are here. This is fragile. Aren't we all? Don't squander all of that possible delicacy of thought on hate. Transform flags of anger into shawls for the cold. Turn the stones you were going to throw into the rocks that we can build with. Thanks so much. Thanks very much, everyone.